Hi, everybody. Welcome to the Rest is History bonus episode. Tom, you have to rush out in
about 25 minutes.
We're literally like grabbing the only time we have. So this will be a slightly shorter one.
But that's okay, because when I go, you could just do a monologue or something.
Yeah, people would love that.
A kind of TED talk.
So Theo wants us to remind you that last week we did chocolate and we did history's greatest monkeys and apes. This week we're starting our great voyage through the Titanic. Next week, Tom, more Titanic.
But Dominic, everyone will have had all six episodes of the Titanic.
They won't have listened to them by now, though, will they?
Yeah, of course they will. Of course they will.
They're more disciplined than they used to be, I think. And ahead, they have two very mighty series. So they've got Martin Luther and Lord Byron.
Yes.
So that's very exciting. So 16th century Europe and then 18th, 19th century.
And maybe we're going to have a show with a guest, aren't we? Perhaps.
I don't think we're allowed to...
To talk about that.
Yeah, a well-known guest.
Okay.
So, because I know you are rushing out, I'm going to ask you a question, and it's from Caput Nilly.
Can I just say one thing about the Titanic that we neglected to talk about, and I'd wanted to talk about?
Okay.
And that was the submersible.
Yeah.
You remember that? It happened?
I do.
So they were very wealthy, weren't they? They went down in a submersible with a rather dodgy company, and they all died. And it was kind of awful because... they were underwater and they had to be rescued, and there was a sense of them being trapped inside this submersible with the time running out.
There was, yes.
And there was a lot of quite unpleasant commentary about it because they were rich.
Slightly jeering, I would have said. Yes, of course.
Slightly jeering. And I was kind of wondering, thinking about the way that the Titanic is framed and understood and the sense of the class divisions on board the ship and how important it is to how it's been seen and say how the James Cameron film was structured and everything.
Mm.
Whether there would have been quite such a reaction if they hadn't been going down to look at the Titanic, whether it was the fact it was the Titanic that kind of turbocharged those reactions. I don't know what you think.
I do think that, because the Titanic is seen as a monument to hubris, isn't it? And to greed and luxury.
Yeah. I think it kind of bought into that narrative.
Totally. I was writing this week an introduction to the Folio Society edition of A Night to Remember, Walter Lord's account of the sinking of the Titanic. And he describes when the ship tips and then plunges. And the way he does it is he lists all the stuff that fell. And he says there'd never been a mixture like it. The jeweled copy of the Rubaiyat, 800 cases of shelled walnuts, 30 cases of golf clubs, Eleanor Widener's trousseau, 30,000 fresh eggs. And then he goes on. An ice-making machine, Billy Carter's new French Renault, the Ryerson's 16 trunks, beautifully packed by Victorine. And the kind of the mordant irony with which he's describing those things, but also the sense, you know, that you shouldn't have a car. You shouldn't take a car across the Atlantic. You shouldn't have 16 trunks that your French maid has packed.
Yeah, it's provoking the anger of the gods.
Yeah. And the issue of it being the wealth and the luxury of it that draws our attention. Because when that submersible got into trouble, the commentary was, well, this is a judgment on the obscene wealth that these people have and their madness and all of this kind of thing. And of course, you know, which of us hasn't taken a tour at some point? Or
a submersible to go and look at a sunk ship.
Well, no, of course. I mean, if I was super rich, I probably wouldn't. But there would be something else, wouldn't there?
God, I definitely wouldn't.
But I mean, I wouldn't get a submersible at all, to be honest with you.
Oh, God, no. But I do think it is the Titanic context that explained a lot of the reaction.
Right.
So that's a kind of coda to the episodes we did on the Titanic that perhaps we should have mentioned it.
Okay. Now, poor old Caput Nilly has been waiting all this time.
Yes.
Because I said I was going to ask his question. I am going to ask it. And it was about Carthage. And his question is this. Tom, to what extent does a great power need an external adversary, a rival, to keep it from turning inward and destroying itself? If that's true, did the end of Carthage inadvertently cause the downfall of the Roman Republic? Just my quick thought about that is actually the Roman Republic doesn't fall because it turned inward. It's because it's expanding too much for the political system, I would say. But I'd be interested to hear your answer.
Well, this is what the Romans themselves thought. So after the war with Hannibal and Carthage is left prostrate and the Romans basically kind of geld it so that it will never be a threat to Rome again. But they're happy to leave it to be an independent state. And Cato the Elder makes his famous argument that Carthage must be destroyed. And he ends every speech in the Senate House with that phrase. And the argument he is making is that it's too dangerous, that Carthage is a malignant power that will always be a danger. So therefore, get rid of it. But the counter argument to this, and it's made very, very seriously, is that the Romans should allow Carthage to exist because it keeps the Romans honest. It keeps them on their toes. It ensures that they will preserve their spirit of manly fortitude.
Mm.
And when in due course Carthage is destroyed and wiped from the face of the earth, and Rome, in the wake of that, in the decades and then the century that follows it, you start to get civil strife on the streets of Rome. There are lots and lots of Roman moralists who interpret this as being an expression of a kind of inward look by the Romans, that now they don't have the threat of Carthage to deal with. They're turning in on themselves and fighting in the streets, and it's turning to civil war, and it's all terrible. And that is very, very soberly held. I mean, I think that that is a moralistic judgment.
Yeah.
That doesn't seem true to me, but it is absolutely
right.
Fair to say that that is the Roman perspective. And I think that the understanding of, say, of ancient peoples on how the world works is very much deserving of respect, because they were there and we weren't. So,
okay.
Right. Shall I give you a question from James von Shetland?
Do. I'd love that.
It's very flattering, Dominic.
Oh, that's nice.
He's been reading your book, The Great British Dream Factory, and it's one of his favourite books. One of the best books I've ever read.
Crikey. He's a good judge.
I wish I'd read it sooner. I can't believe I'm having to read this. Do you feel British culture in the 20th century is uniquely British, or is it just a continuation of Western culture? So how British is British culture that you're writing about?
It's uniquely British. So there is such a thing as Western culture. There are definitely commonalities. And if there weren't, then, you know, a lot of Hollywood studios would not have made the money they did. They made by exporting films to territories in which, despite the language gap or whatever, people were able to appreciate that they had stories in common, there were motifs that made sense to people, and so on and so forth. But British culture in the 20th century, there is such a thing. I think there's actually an argument that a relatively homogenous British popular culture exists in the 20th century in a way that perhaps it hadn't quite before, because of there are now national institutions and national communications. BBC, obviously, national newspapers, such that people are laughing at the same jokes in Cornwall or in Northumberland in a way they wouldn't quite have been beforehand. And of course, the national culture reflects a sense of a shared national story, a shared historical experience, I suppose, that means that it is different from Finnish culture or Portuguese culture or whatever. Go on, Tom, you've got a thought.
Well, so he's talking about British culture.
Yeah.
And you said from Cornwall too, and I was waiting to see whether you'd say Shetland.
Yeah, but I should have done, actually.
But you said Northumbria.
It's just I forgot about Scotland.
Right. So our Scottish listeners will be thrilled to hear that.
But I would have said, but there is a British culture.
So there is a British culture that's not just English culture.
Yes. Yeah, and actually when I wrote that book, some SNP people, fervent Scottish nationalists, didn't like it, because they didn't believe there is such a thing as Britain or British culture. And I think that they're quite obviously wrong. So the figure of James Bond, for example.
Yeah, of course.
Strikes me as a British figure. He is, of course, in the books, he is, in inverted commas, projected as English, even though his mother is Swiss. And he goes to school, depending on which version you read, either at Eton or at Fettes in Scotland. He's first played by a Scottish actor. He's been played by an Irish actor. So, I mean, there are people, you said about the Shetland Isles or the Orkneys or wherever. People there are watching BBC programs projected with a sense of there being a British audience. Of course, it's not totally homogenous. There are people in Wales or in Northern Ireland or indeed in Cornwall who would say we're not the same as the people in London. But to deny that there is such a thing as a Britishness...
Well, a hostility to London is a truly British.
Yeah, it's a British phenomenon.
Yeah.
Don't you think, Tom, you think Britishness is a thing in the 20th century, don't you?
I'm just thinking, I mean, lots of the things you write about are very English.
Of course, because the English are the 80% or more of the population.
But Lord of the Rings, for instance,
yeah,
is designed as a mythology for the English, isn't it? Tolkien wasn't really keen on the idea of Britain.
It is. It is, of course, but people love it and read it in...
Yeah, sure. I'm just playing devil's advocate.
But Tolkien likes Welsh mythology, likes Irish mythology.
Well, Harry Potter. I mean, Harry Potter is very British, isn't it? King's Cross to Scotland.
Yeah, absolutely. Educated in Scotland.
Yeah.
If you went through that book and you ringed every name in the text that is Welsh, Irish, Scottish, or indeed in some other way not purely English. There are a lot of names, I would say.
So I think that the birth of a British culture, as opposed to an English or a Scottish or Welsh culture.
Yeah, it's really interesting.
Is actually one of the themes that makes Byron's career interesting, because Byron is a properly British figure. So his full name, George Gordon Noel Byron, but his lordship is an English one, centered on Newstead Abbey outside Nottingham. But his mother is Scottish and he's raised in Scotland. He goes to school in Aberdeen. And I think his Britishness is a crucial part of his image. And he's seen as a poetic embodiment of Britain and an enemy of Britain.
Right.
So something to explore.
Yeah. I mean, obviously, people have always conflated England and Britain, haven't they, for a very long time.
Yeah.
Digging into that relationship would be very interesting. It'd be a very interesting episode of the podcast, actually.
So here's a question from Harold Stassen. When did it become common to use the term democracy when describing the British political system? Or indeed, you know, what we would now call other democracies, America or France or wherever. Was it a product of rhetoric during the World Wars or are there earlier instances? I mean, my immediate response to that is that the word democracy is one that lots of people are very hostile to around the time the American Republic is being established, around the time the French Republic is being established. And it's noticeable that both of them are republics rather than democracies, because democracy is associated with Athens and it's seen as being demagogic and prone to collapse. The Athenian democracy implodes. This is the narrative. And that changes over the course of the 19th century.
Yeah, I was going to say probably the 19th century. I mean, there's obviously reform movements in the 19th century that are seeking to expand the franchise, that are appealing to democratic instincts. So I would say democracy, by the end of the 19th century, the idea that democracy is something to be feared. I mean, other than like Lord Salisbury, I mean, who happened to be the prime minister, you know, kind of cranky aristocrats and things, diehards. I think most people see democracy as a virtue rather than a vice. I also think, certainly in the course of the 19th century, certainly by the end of the 19th century, the idea of the British Parliament as the mother of parliaments and of reflecting some kind of democratic spirit is quite strongly entrenched. Actually, one thing that really interests me is, I mean, it's slight tangent, but only slight, is that, of course, the French Revolution stands for liberty, fraternity, and equality. But the idea of liberty, I mean, the British say in the Napoleonic Wars and the French Revolutionary Wars that they are fighting for liberty. So liberty, the idea of freedom, which is, of course, slightly allied to democracy, that's always part of Britishness, I would say, from 1707 onwards. So the democratic impulse is always there, even if it is contested, I would argue.
I mean, there is very hardwired into the British political system the notion that the more property and possessions you have, the more of a right to a vote you have.
Yeah.
And that reflects the Roman Republican system. I mean, they believe that as well in the Republic.
Yeah.
Votes were very much kind of weighted according to how much property you had. Mm. And that is something that obviously does change over the course of the 19th century. So I guess that democracy starts to lose its pejorative connotations with the Great Reform Act.
Yeah, yeah.
And then, of course, you have the issue of votes for women. And democracy by this point is starting to be framed in terms of rights.
Yes.
That if, you know, all male voters have a right to a vote, then why don't women? And that's an unarguable case. And so women get the vote as well. But the association of democracy with rights is not something that you get in Athens.
No.
And it's something that I think clearly evolves in the modern period. And now we take it for granted. And Sir Harold Stassen talks about how democracy is part of the rhetoric of during the World Wars. I mean, that is clearly the case, isn't it? So in the 30s, the idea of France and Britain as the democracies.
Yes, absolutely.
That just becomes a descriptor that everybody uses.
Yeah. I think it's sharpened definitely by the arrival of the dictators. I don't think people talk about the democracies. I know they don't. They don't talk about it at all the same way.
Well, because they're not really democracies. I mean, they're not primarily democracies. You know, if half the population don't have the vote.
Right. As we've said before, there are cases that Germany, you know, Wilhelmine Germany was more democratic than its, in inverted commas, some of its democratic, certainly it was more democratic than Tsarist Russia. And arguably in some ways with this big trade union movement, social democratic side and whatnot, than Britain.
Well, New Zealand and Australia, though, palpably more democratic than Britain.
Definitely, definitely. Okay, a good question for you. we've been in the middle of recording the Luther series. And one of the things that we're bringing out of that, one of the themes we're drawing out, is the sense of apocalyptic dread in Europe because the Ottomans are at the gates. And S.W. Jacobs has a question. If the Ottomans a century later, for example, had been victorious at Vienna, of course they're at Vienna again in the 1520s, and then they're at Vienna a century later. If they'd been victorious, if they had swept through Europe, was it ever realistic, Tom, that 17th century or later Europe would embrace Islam rather than Christianity?
I mean, even if they captured Vienna, they would have lost it soon afterwards because there's imperial overreach. I mean, it's evident that there is a limit to how far beyond Constantinople that you can go.
Yeah.
And particularly in the context of Europe industrializing,
yeah,
and getting a technological lead over the Ottomans and the rest of the Islamic world, it's never going to happen. Say it did. I mean, say the Ottomans established their rule over Austria or southern Germany or whatever, would they have turned Muslim? I mean, the Ottomans, in a way, like all Muslim empires, have an interest in ensuring that conquered peoples don't become Muslim.
Yeah.
Because written into the Quran is this concept of the jizya, which peoples of the book, so Jews and Christians, are allowed to practice their religion freely, provided that they acknowledge their submission by paying a tax. And this is very important to the functioning of the Ottoman economy. So if you look at the Balkans, there are, of course, substantial populations of Muslims there, mm-hmm, who are a consequence of conversion during the period of Ottoman occupation. But I think what's striking is how Christianized the Balkans remain.
Yeah, I totally agree.
Despite the fact that Ottoman rule is there for, you know, look at Greece.
That was exactly the point I was going to make, yeah.
And of course, our sense of that, I think, is slewed by the fact that there are population exchanges in the 20th century that, say, the Muslims in Greece get expelled and the Greeks get expelled from what will become Turkey. But I still think it's really striking how Christianity remains very, very vital,
yeah,
in the Ottoman world, and people don't all convert.
Well, no. I mean, the further you get from Constantinople, so Bulgaria, Serbia, I mean, of course, they are in Hungary for a time. Islam doesn't become, I mean, there are Muslims, as you rightly say, and if you wanted to prosper in the imperial bureaucracy, if you're ambitious, you know, you might well convert, but lots of peasants don't, lots of people don't.
Yeah.
And that tells its own story. So if the Ottomans do get to Germany, so what? Most people probably stay Christian as they were before.
Right. And there's a further consideration, which is that Greece and the Balkans are largely Orthodox. I mean, not all of them, but largely. Austria and Germany are Latin. And I think that there has been a fundamental development in Latin Christendom that you don't get in Byzantium and the Orthodox world, which is the emergence of the concept of the secular.
Mm-hmm.
And we're going to be talking a little bit about this in the Reformation episodes. But essentially, in the 11th century, which is not coincidentally the period when you have the great schism between the Latin and Greek worlds in Christendom, a kind of division becomes institutionalized in Latin Christendom between what is called the dimension of the saeculum, which is the earthly, and the dimension of religio, which is the bond that joins Christian people to heaven. And this essentially, in the long run, will become the division between the secular and the concept of religion, which people in the West take so for granted that they just assume that it's, you know, it's just kind of like, surely everybody has it. No, it's very, very distinctive and unique to the West. And it is not a part of the way that Islam understands the world. And so I think that that is part of why, say, for Muslims coming to the West in the 20th century and in the 21st century, it's part of the process of adaptation to living in a Western country that has proved hardest, is kind of recognizing that Islam, rather than being a framework for governing every aspect of life, that it has to conceptualize itself as something called a religion and be parked on the sides of something that is called the secular.
Mm.
And by the 17th century, this has become so much a part of the way that Western Europeans think, that I think that Islam of the kind practiced by the Ottomans is very indigestible. And it's not really, I mean, it is Christianity because it derives from Christianity. But by that point, you know, the notion of the secular has become something separate from Christian identity. It's just something that everybody accepts. And I just think that an Islamic empire would have had huge problems with that.
All right. Do we have time for one more question, Tom, or not?
Not really.
Okay, right. Well, on that bombshell.
No. You can answer it.
You're going and leaving me to answer the question.
Yes. Okay, so this is a good one. This is a favourite. We've had it before. Lambert Simnel Cake. Excluding the Tudors, Nazis, and the Industrial Revolution, what three historical areas should all school children be taught? And I assume school children in England or Britain or wherever. I know you're going to say the Civil Wars.
Yeah, or around the world. They still do that.
Okay. Dominic, could I just say goodbye to you? Goodbye to the listeners.
And you haven't said goodbye to Tabby, which is sad.
And I'm going to say goodbye to Tabby, of course.
Yeah, you forgot until I mentioned it. The damage is done.
Thank you, Tabby. Bye-bye, everyone.
Right, well, Tom goes, I'm going to answer the question. Lambert Simnel Cake says, excluding the bloody Tudors, the Nazis, and the Industrial Revolution. As if to say, oh, a terrible thing they do the Tudors. They do the Tudors for a damn good reason. They do the Tudors because it's nice and self-contained. It's got great personalities, not just the monarch and the six wives and Elizabeth I and Mary and stuff, but all the hangers-on, the Thomas Cromwells and the Cranmers and all those people. They're great characters. It's an absolutely massive transformative moment, the English Reformation. It's got the Spanish Armada in. It's got Shakespeare at the end. Why wouldn't you want to do that? Just because you're bored of it doesn't mean that a 10-year-old who's never done it before is going to be bored of it. They will probably find it really exciting. You know, again, the Nazis, we've heard the story. But if you're 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 14, 15, you haven't heard the story. So obviously you're going to do it. It's a really, really interesting story. Now, you can moan and groan about the Nazis as much as you like, but I don't think I'm betraying any industrial secrets when I say those Nazi episodes that we've done on The Rest Is History are by far our most popular and most downloaded episodes. And there's a good reason for that. It is an absolutely fascinating story. The Industrial Revolution, I will agree with you, Lambert Simnel Cake. I personally find it very boring. I found it excruciatingly boring at school because it didn't have enough fighting in it, or indeed any fighting, which is really what I craved. But you can understand again why people do it. Now, as for three other areas, I think they should do the Anglo-Saxons. Children in England, particularly, should do the Anglo-Saxons because that's the beginning of England. Tom and I are both on record as saying they should do the Civil War period, so the 17th century. And you know what? I think it is important to do some international history to understand places that are totally different from ourselves and that challenge our own preconceptions of what is normal. And so I think we should either do some Welsh or Scottish history to really shake things up a bit. And on that bombshell, Tom has long since gone. He didn't think I'd keep this going for as long as I did. But on that bombshell, I will say goodbye to all of you and we'll see you all next week. Goodbye.